Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, house prices are at a record high compared to wages. How much longer can this go on for? One thing that has come to a rather abrupt end is super low fixed mortgage deals. As rates climb, what can you do if you need to fix this year? And would you accept crypto for your Caribbean hideaway? Plus today, as there's talk, energy bills could hit $3,000 a year. To fix or not to fix? That is the question. And Avios Points Bonanza. Is it time to get a credit card? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news just to go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, house prices, my favourite subject. The reason, if you are new to the podcast, why historically, famously, I don't like house prices is because back in the good old days, before pandemics and the like, you'd get about 15 different ones a month, all totally varied. Now, they may all be slightly different, that is true, but they all say essentially the same thing. That house prices at the moment are completely nuts. It laughs in the face of financial crises, Brexits, pandemics. So can anything halt this juggernaut that is the UK housing market? Simon, you've been writing about this. Exactly how high are prices at the moment? Give us some figures.
In monetary terms, the Nationwide House Price Index, which is the most recent of the house price indices to emerge and updates us on what happened up to February, so i.e. last month, the average home now costs £260,320. There will be some of our listeners who are sitting there thinking, that's pretty much bang on what it cost me to buy the bog standard average home, not bog standard, the lovely average home in my local area. There will be other listeners sitting there thinking, how much are these people paying for these houses? What on earth is going on? You could get a mansion round here for that. Probably not a mansion. There will also be many of our listeners going, I wish I could buy a house for £260,000, and who are facing much higher prices. This is the problem with the average house. But you have to have an average somewhere, and that's where it falls. What you want to do is look at what's happening to the cost of that average house. And it has gone up by 12.6% over the past year. Talk about a cost of living crisis. That has added £29,000 to the cost of the average home. The average home is in fact 20% more expensive than it was in February 2020 when the pandemic began. That is £44,000 more. Now, as I said, there will be some people for whom that's £20,000 more. There will be others in the more expensive parts of the country, where lots of our listeners may be living, where actually buying that average home or average family house is now £100,000 more expensive. Might even be £200,000 more expensive. House prices have gone completely bananas, which it should be said is the absolute opposite of what everybody expected to happen when the pandemic first hit and the property freeze kicked in. Now, what's caused this? Many different things. You had the element of pent-up demand from the year running up to the pandemic, when the property market was really struggling in most places. That was the Brexit negotiation year. Ironically, people were much more fearful of making the huge commitment of buying a new house in the Brexit negotiation fear than they were when a global pandemic struck and they were all confined to their homes. Being confined to their homes made them think, you know what, actually, I quite like to live in another home, or a home with more space, or a home with a bigger garden, or a home that's closer to the countryside. I think maybe I can get away with a longer commute now because I don't have to be so close to the office. Maybe don't do some of those kind of crazy things you see property features on, like moving to Berwick-on Tweed, because you'll get a shock when your boss says they want you back in. And also, I think it was just an element of itchy feet, people having saved a bit more money, and cheap mortgages. Cheap mortgages play a huge part in this. Mortgage rates may have risen recently. We're going to talk about that in a bit, but they are still exceptionally cheap. Banks are very keen to lend. And bar a blip or a wobble at the start of the pandemic, banks have largely done okay and are very happy to dish out mortgages. But the real measure of how expensive a house is, in my mind, is how it compares to the thing that lets you pay for that house. And the thing that lets you, or the vast majority of people, pay for their home is what they earn. It's their wages. The house price to earnings ratio, which is based on the average house price, the average earnings, according to the ONS, now has the dubious distinction of reaching a record high. 6.6 is the ratio. House prices, 6.6 times higher than the average wage. That is higher than it was at the peak of the 2000s boom, which was 6.4, and that was the highest it had ever been. And to put that into the longer term context, even at the peak of the 1980s property boom, the average house price to earnings ratio was 4.9. So basically, on this ultimately crucial measure, houses are way too expensive. Older listeners will be saying, whoa, 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 sunshine, what about double-digit interest rates in the late 1980s and early 1990s? To which I would say, well, yes, you had double-digit interest rates, but we have very expensive houses now. And those two things are interlinked. And the affordability now is worse. It might be that you can get a much bigger mortgage and pay lower monthly payments on it. But fundamentally, the affordability, the how are you going to buy a house? You need to go out and earn some money. It's much more expensive. And it's almost two entire full-time salaries more expensive in terms of that relationship between wages and house prices.
And so therefore, the solution, is there a solution? Lee, is this going to end anytime soon? I mean, I said there, it laughs in the face of all of these things. We've had so many predictions, haven't we? 18% fall after Brexit. They've not come. They've not come true. It's gone the absolute opposite direction.
Well, it's become out of reach for the majority of people, especially solo buyers, as you say. I mean, it's becoming more and more tricky as the years have gone by. And at the start of the pandemic, we've been sitting here saying in 2 years' time, this is the conversation we were going to be having about the housing market. I don't think either of the three of us would really believe it, to be quite frank with you. And I think in these stats, and there's a key stat in here from Property Mark in this story, and basically there are currently 19 homes for sale per estate agency office compared to an average of 552 registered house hunters. That means a typical estate agent has 29 potential buyers for every available property. I mean, that is the crux of it. There's not enough good quality homes for people to buy. And when something does come up that's attractive, people are piling in, and we're hearing all sorts of things about bidding wars and all that kind of thing, because there's such a lack of supply to keep up with demand. And actually, this week, I mean, given everything that's going on in the world, I had a letter through the post. It's been posted by a local estate agent talking about the little area I live in my town. It's quite sought after for families. It's near a train station. And he was talking in this letter about he was setting up a price alert system for just this little zone of the town I live in to keep people abreast of the property market. And P.S., if you want to sell your house at the moment, it's a really good time to do it because there's so many people that want to move to this little pocket of the town, almost just like ramping up prices even more and trying to get more homes on the books because they're struggling to get people to do it. Now, on the flip side of this, we have a story today from Zoopla. And Zoopla, I feel like I've been sounding this kind of, not just Zoopla, but a lot of the sort of places that report on house prices and things, keep talking about, well, there's signs that there's slowdown. And then we get sort of what something like Nationwide saying the complete opposite, and it's still trundling along. But Zoopla basically have come out today and saying that more expensive mortgages, as Simon just said, and we're going to talk about in a minute, surging living costs and economic headwinds will put the brakes on UK's rampaging house prices. Which I said, okay, all right, what we're talking then, what are they predicting it's going to fall by? But they're still saying that they are saying by December property price growth will slow to 3.5%. Well, you know, that's not exactly like some sort of like mega crash, is it? It's still they're predicting prices to keep ticking higher. And I think really the long and short of it is this supply and demand issue. There's still a hell of a lot of first-time buyers out there that are looking to get on the property market and taking advantage of something like the lifetime ISA. We had some reports out this week suggesting that a lot more people are maxing out their lifetime ISAs in a bid to get onto the property market, get onto the property ladder. So I know it's hard to predict, George, as we always say on this show, don't we? It's always hard to predict what's going to happen between now and this time next year. And it's almost impossible. You know, as I say, when we started at the start of the pandemic and there was all sorts of doom mongering around about house prices collapsing and all that kind of thing, just haven't come true. Mm. But you would suspect that pricier mortgages, you know, turmoil in Ukraine, interest rates, cost of living, all of those things, you mix all of those kind of things, you wouldn't expect house prices to keep growing, would you?
You know, global pandemics, Brexit, wars, all that sort of thing, it still keeps trundling along, doesn't it? Why would that be the case, Simon, if mortgage rates do continue to increase, the cost of living is going bananas, etc., etc.? Is it just people defaulting on their mortgages and having to sell up and therefore that freeing up some houses? Is it as sort of gloomy as that?
Actually, the brakes would be more likely to be slammed on by the affordability issue, which is that banks have to, and building societies have to, assess people on affordability, so their incomings and their outgoings. And
so if fewer buyers around. So if you're more houses,
well, it would limit what buyers can pay because they wouldn't be able to borrow as much money because their outgoings are going up, and banks are already starting to factor this stuff in. So for example, they'll look at how much you're paying on your energy bills. Now, my energy bills are going to double because our fixed rate is going to end and the price cap is going to go up. And the effect on that means that come the 1st of April, I'm going to be paying twice as much for my energy bills. Not everybody's in that position, but there's quite a lot of people in that position, and the banks know this. And so they are factoring in the fact that they might not be factoring in people's fixed rates coming to an end, but they are going to be factoring in the fact that the price cap's going to go up. So when they look at the energy bills element, they're going to go, okay, well, that's going to go up. When they look at the amount that people are spending on food, transport, other things, they're going to go, well, that's going to go up. And say that takes £50 to £100 out of your affordability calculation. Well, that's £50 to £100 that they're going to say you now can't afford on your mortgage. And when you translate that £50 to £100 to how much that equates to in terms of monthly payment versus what you can borrow in thousands of pounds, you're talking tens of thousands of pounds. Not huge tens of thousands of pounds, low tens of thousands of pounds. And so that is going to say people are going to be like, well, I can't offer £10,000 more for that property, because I can't borrow £10,000 more for that property and I don't have £10,000. Because there's two ways of paying. You've either got the money or you borrow the money. And for most people, it's borrowing the money that really matters, because the amount of money they have is limited. They can't just go find extra money. And that fundamentally is what manages to keep prices going up ever and ever higher, is people managing to borrow more money. Now, we've seen a scenario where interest rates have gone down, so people have been able to borrow more money. We've seen a scenario where people are taking longer and longer mortgages, which means that you spread it over a longer period, so the monthly payments are lower, people can borrow more money. We've seen other tricks like that going on, but there is a limit to how much of that stuff you can do. We are possibly at that limit at the moment. Now, the question is whether banks and building societies then loosen their affordability criteria. We had news this week that the Bank of England is talking about changing the stress test. We had news this week that they're also talking about potentially changing the limit on the number of high loans value mortgages that banks can do. Changing the stress test, they said it actually won't affect that many people, but the stress test is, could you afford if you went to the SVR, the standard variable rate, plus 3%, which is considered to be unrealistic because most people don't ever go to the standard variable rate. They remortgage onto another fix. Standard variable rates are already very high, considerably higher than fixed rates, and then adding another 3% to it is considered to be an unrealistically high mortgage rate. Now, if they remove that, that creates a little bit of extra wiggle room. The other thing I think that you could potentially see is a return to some element of interest only. That's the thing that suddenly starts boosting the amount that people can borrow, because of the way that lowers the monthly payments, then increases that affordability calculation. Or would we see a return to that early 2000s boom of, do you want some more money, mate? You could go interest only. Don't worry about a repayment plan. I don't think that's necessarily likely, but we're already seeing a bit of movement around interest only, certainly with the borrowers on higher salaries and stuff like that, who've always continued to be able to do it. Now, they do want you to have a plan in place, but it is now acceptable, whereas it wasn't immediately after the financial crisis when tire rules were brought in, to say that your plan is to sell your home. That's how you're going to pay off the mortgage. You're going to sell your home. Now, obviously, the problem is you're then going to have to live somewhere, which is why that's not a brilliant plan for most people. But, you know, that could be the thing that sees it. And what is going to push on that door is the fact that banks and building societies are very well capitalized. We've got them revealing that they've been making bumper profits. A lot of that is coming from the fact that they set aside money in the early days of the pandemic to cover losses, you know, write-offs and things like that. And then those things haven't emerged. So they're now pulling that money back in. So they're still well capitalized, they're still making lots of money, house prices are going up. That's a time when they think, we want to lend people more money because we want to make more money. And if you look at the profits they're making on their mortgage books, they're pretty good at the moment. The other thing that comes into this is, well, isn't it just a question of supply and demand? Don't we just need to build more houses? It's that simple, just need to build a load more houses. It's an easy thing to say, but when you actually look at the evidence, firstly, in order to substantially lower the average house price back down to that long-term relationship with wages, you would need to build an unbelievable amount of houses. Like, I mean, a really, really large amount of houses, way more than the target. Secondly, actually, bar the pandemic bit, where we obviously there was the stop from people working, we have been building more houses in recent years than we have built for a very, very long time. And then also there's research that shows that high house prices are not the function of simply supply and demand. There was a Bank of England paper a couple of years back on basically how it's cheap mortgages that have driven up house prices. I'm quoting here. It said, we find that the rise in real house prices since 2000 can be explained almost entirely by lower interest rates. Increasing scarcity of housing, evidenced by real rental prices and their expected growth, has played a negligible role at the national level. On top of that, new build homes are almost always, I'm not quoting anymore, by the way. On top of that, new build homes are almost always sold at a premium. If you want to, anybody can find this out. Go look at new build homes near you and then compare them to the cost of secondhand homes. They're always sold at a premium. They do not lower the price in the local market. You're not seeing lower prices on the existing homes due to them. You just see more expensive prices on the new build home. And the Letwin Review in 2018 looked in detail at this and said that builders deliberately build slowly so as not to bring down house prices. And he said that's just simple business. They want to maintain their profits. They don't want to flood the market. They want to maximize their profits. And so they build out, even on really big, estates where they're delivering thousands of homes, they build out at a rate that will not depress the level of local house prices. So it's not just as simple as going, we need to build more homes. This is fundamentally, there is an issue with homes. We probably haven't built enough. The right types of homes in the right types of places. We've got too many people trying to move to certain parts of the country and not enough people trying to move to other parts of the country and everything like that. But it is basically cheap money. It's difficult to see where it stops, but it will stop at one point. And so the only thing I would say, and this is why I wrote my column, is basically that line's going up in the sky really quite sharply. That's the time you want to be quite wary. You want to remember that this is how inflation works. People worry that stuff is going to go up more in price in the future, so they buy it now, and that helps drive up the price. You need to try to avoid overpaying for a property and be really careful of paying top whack for any home that you cannot add any value to, because you're just paying the top price for that. And if people suddenly stop paying top prices, you're the person holding the bag. And for homeowners also who've got a fixed rate mortgage, if it's coming up for renewal this year, start exploring your options now, because you can lock into new mortgages quite a long time in advance. Interest rates are rising. Life is getting more expensive. That house price graph will not keep going straight up in the air forever.
Thank you very much, Simon. Lee, let's talk about the mortgage rates, shall we? Lots of good tips there from Simon. The final one I'm going to pick up on is what to do if your fix is coming to an end. You know, tie in now because rates are low. Give us an idea of how low they are, because they're not as super duper low as they were like a year ago.
Well, it's good advice from Simon, because there are going to be people in this boat. And actually, I had a quick look this morning at the best 2-year fix and 5-year fix for remortgages, and the best buy that I saw earlier in the week has gone. So there is definitely a movement upwards in terms of rates. And we have said for quite a bit of time, they were so low. You think back to the summer, we were talking about, I think there was a rate at 0.83%. Which is just absolutely phenomenally low when you're talking about mortgage rates. And Simon was saying earlier in the show about double digit, you know, mortgage rates in the 80s and 90s. I mean, it has been so, so low. And people have taken advantage of this. You know, they have gone and remortgaged onto a much lower rate, potentially because their property price has grown, so they've got more equity in the house, and perhaps managed to get into a 60% LTV. Which is going to give you the sort of lowest price mortgage on the market. I think a lot of people have done that. I think a lot of people might have also decided that mortgages weren't going to get any cheaper, and perhaps to take a 5-year fix. And we've even seen, we spoke about this on the show a little while back, didn't we, about 10-year fixed mortgages. I think some people have even been tempted into those, and some mainstream lenders are now offering 10-year fixes like Lloyds. And I think that has tempted people. We've discussed the pros and cons of that on a previous show. But yeah, to give you a real flavour of this, so for example, on a typical 2-year mortgage, we're talking about across the board here, I'm not talking about Best Buys, on a 25% deposit, in February 2020, it was 2.27%. And then it bottomed out on the 1st of September 2021 to 2.03%. And now, as of a couple of weeks ago, it was 2.43%. So it's ticked up higher than it was in February 2020. And I would suspect that that might have even nudged a little bit higher since these stats were done for us last week. And then on a 25% deposit on a 5-year fix, talking 2.56% on the 1st of February 2020, bottomed out on the 1st of September 2021 at 2.26%. And now it's 2.7%. Again, that has probably ticked higher. And as I mentioned, I've seen some of the best rates sort of disappear this week. And some of the big banks have passed on base rate rises. The same banks on the whole haven't passed on the same rate rises onto savers. You know, still, there's quite a number of high street banks, not all, but quite a lot, are at 0.01% for savers. And that, it's not great news. But in the flip side of that, the last 5 years or so, mortgage rates have just been so low. At some point, there was going to come a time when they started nudging higher. Base rate rises have obviously prompted that. And if you are someone who is remortgaging this year, it's well worth looking at your options well ahead of time, because you can lock into a deal, depending on who your lender is, earlier than just on the date of remortgaging. So it's worth exploring your options and having a look. But what I would add to that is that I wouldn't want to panic people.
I was going to say, we're not going to see what Simon was talking about earlier, the sort of double digits, 80s and 90s effort.
We're talking about nudging higher in terms of, you know, we've seen sort of half a percentage point added on to quite a lot of the major lenders, but half a percentage point on mortgages that were perhaps 1.5%. You know, they're not going to start going up like house prices, just absolutely like racing ahead. Well, at least I hope they wouldn't. But it's one of those things, you'll see just little incremental changes as the months go on. How much extra is added on between now and say 6 months' time? I mean, it's again crystal ball gazing, and it's too difficult to predict. But you know, it all again depends on the circumstances. I'd be having a look at what rates, you know, we're on offer now. Potentially locking in if you're remortgaging, and I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, rates continue just to trickle higher. As I said, you know, I mentioned those rates on the 25% deposit just then and read them out. You know, we're talking about, you know, literally like 0.15% percentage points higher than February 2020. So it's not like we're talking huge hundreds of pounds added onto your mortgage each month type scenario here.
All right. Well, talking of fixing, we'll go there now. Just as we're all getting emails and letters through the post saying our energy bills are shooting up over 50% from April, more for Simon, obviously, because you're coming off your fix, to an average of £1,971 a year. There is talk our energy bills could hit £3,000 or more come October due to the current conflict in Ukraine. So while fixed deals are being offered at the moment look eye-wateringly high, has the advice changed at all as to whether you should just wait it out on your standard variable tariff or should you actually grab one of these fixed rate deals? Simon, £3,000, where's that come from?
It's come from the expectation that the price cap will have to go up by another 50% due to rising gas prices and electricity prices as well, but largely gas prices caused by the Russia-Ukraine war, basically.
How likely is it? Is it just based on the fact that, you know, when Russia invaded, wholesale gas prices went up, what, 40%, and therefore if it continues to go like that, I'm like, how do you know how this whole thing is going to play out and how it's going to impact? But the reality is it's going to impact on our bills, which are already going up.
Well, I mean, the prediction was that the cap was already going to go up by quite a lot anyway, that the run in gas prices upwards was not going to stop before the price cap was refreshed in autumn. It's not just random finger in the air stuff. It's coming from analysts, experts. I mean, one of the experts in this is a firm called Cornwall Insights, and they were pretty much right on the last price cap rise. And this is what they are saying might happen with the next price cap rise. The difficulty that people face is A, it might not happen. So do they fix in order to try to stave it off and probably end up paying more money for the next 6 months than they would otherwise have to? And are energy suppliers already factoring this in? Yeah. And are the fixed deals so expensive that there isn't much point taking them? Because people are being offered £3,000 deals at the moment. So you can see the issue here, can't you? I mean, if it goes up to £3,000 and you start paying £3,000 now, you've just spent 6 months paying more than you need to. If it goes above that, then you win. But energy suppliers are not... I was just about to say energy suppliers are not stupid. Most of the remaining energy suppliers are not stupid. Yeah. Many of the energy suppliers that have gone bust turned out to maybe not be quite as clever as they thought they were.
Of the ones left, though, Lee, if you took a look on a comparison website, you, like Sam says, I mean, you're going to get figures of 3,000, whatever. But there may be some deals you might get through your own energy company. Not me, I'm with British Gas. I took a look, nothing there. E.ON, though, last week, tell us about what they did.
Yeah, this is quite crackers, I think, in my mind. It was quite a surprising move, and I saw quite a few people talking about this on Twitter. So for existing customers, it launched a one-year fixed deal at £1,977, so the forthcoming the price cap. But for 1 year, a lot of people snapped that up because, you know, there's talk of this £3,000 price cap coming in later on in the year. So you're kind of thinking, well, might as well lock into that. That sounds relatively cheap. If I can keep it under £2,000 and then come next winter, you know where you're at. You know what you're paying. But they were inundated, unsurprisingly, by its own customer base, and they pulled it pretty quickly and realised that people just wanted that tariff. You know, there's nothing much better out there. And it also had a two-year deal at £2,071, which in a way I think may have even been more attractive to people because that stability for 2 years, yes, that's going to be a pricier energy bill. But as I say, you know, the worry over what's happening, you know, in Europe and what's going to happen to gas prices, people locked into it and went for it and it disappeared really quickly. It's since launched another 1 year fix at £2,270 a year. The key point to this, though, is that there's no exit fees if prices fall. So
right,
it's a bit of a gamble.
Well, that's it, Lee. What do you do?
I mean, it's really hard. I mean, personally speaking, like, I would just be keeping an eye on what your provider's offering. And if other providers offer snap deals like that,
Do you think they will? Do you think that's likely? Or are they going to look at Aeon and think, like you did, that's crackers? What was the point of that?
I don't know. And it's quite interesting because new customers of Aeon, the price is £3,158. So I think...
Because no one wants any new customers. They just had 4.5 million, haven't they?
Yeah, but what I was trying to say about that is that that's for another 1 year fix. And actually, psychologically, as an existing customer being offered it for sort of 1,977 and a new customer 3,158, you go, "Cool, that's massive." You know, and you would take that, wouldn't you? You would say, "Yeah, I'll take that 1 year," but bite your hand off. And that's what happened. And I'd be surprised if we see much more of that, if I'm being honest with you. And I've said this before, we're coming into a point now where, you know, the weather will start changing. We'll be less reliant on heating. But it's what happens come later in the year. It's almost like kicking the can down the road, isn't it? I mean, when you think about winter, I don't want to think about winter already for the next winter after, you know, coming out of the other side of this one. But, you know, it's going to be such bill shocks for people. It really is, and it's a frightening prospect. So, you know, I say Aeon are crackers, but I tell you what, if you manage to take advantage of that and that stability and knowing how much you're going to be paying, then, you know, you may as well take full advantage. And who's to say that there won't be more of this going on? Who knows? Yeah.
Simon, do you think, I mean, we've got a couple of measures coming in from the government. Do you think the Chancellor might use this upcoming budget to announce some more help? What should they do? What can you do?
The help was slightly underwhelming, wasn't it?
Yes,
you're going to get some money off your energy bills, and then you can pay it back over 4 years.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not, to which a lot of people are like, well, can I just say no to the help, thanks? And you know, you're basically offering me less than 20 quid a month and then I've got to pay it back over 4 years. It just sounds like a real pain in the backside.
And then you get a refund on your council tax, but council tax is going up, so that refund looks a little bit less generous as well, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And not everybody's getting a refund council tax. I'm not getting a refund on my council tax. There was lots of stories about people who live in very expensive houses in London that are still band D who are getting refunds on their council tax day, which is nice. It's difficult, isn't it? And I think that anything he does will need to be targeted. This is going to hit everybody, though. To be honest, I think that even people in my position who know about this, saw it coming down the line, looked at it and thought, okay, well, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, my energy bills are not the biggest chunk of my monthly expenditure. We pay about £150 a month for our combined energy bills. I can afford for that to go up a bit. I can grin and bear it. I'm not going to be happy about it. I don't really want to pay any more money. It's not like I'm flush with spare cash in the joint account at the end of the month, but it'll be okay. And then you suddenly discover that it's going to double to 300 quid. And you think, hang on a minute, 300 quid. Where am I going to find an extra 150 quid at the same time as I've got to find an extra 50 quid to fill up the car? I've got to find a bit more money for the train to work. Got to find a bit more money to pay for this. Got to find a bit more money to pay for that. It's squeezing people at all levels. But, you know, I'm in a far, far better position. We're all in a far, far better position than the people who are really struggling, for whom this is going to be a real, real problem. The people who are going to be sitting there in the dark with the heating off and stuff like that. But it is true that people's energy bills vary wildly. I'll let our readers into a little behind the curtain conversation here. A certain person was telling us that she pays that her electricity bill was so low that me and Lee were suspicious that it couldn't possibly be right.
£9.47.
I mean, I don't understand how you could only use £9.47 worth of electricity.
I'm on
a
direct
month,
debit for £51. There was only a conversation with them yesterday that went, I think we need to change this because you've got quite a lot of money on this account. And my gas as well was completely wrong. So either I'm incredibly good at turning out the lights and not washing my clothes, which is pretty grim, really. Or there's something wrong with that. But I don't know. They said it's right. I mean, what are my rights then? If they've convinced me it's right, they've got a smart meter, et cetera, et cetera. Can they come racing back to me and demand this money? Because I was very reassured.
Well, excellent question, actually. If you're on a smart meter, can Reader they come back? Can they come back to you for a billing error in the future? Because they're only allowed to go back a year, unless you have tried to dupe them in some way.
Should we do this in about 9 months?
On a normal meter reading. But what about on a smart meter? And it's funny because this reflects a conversation that I was having with some friends on a WhatsApp group yesterday. We talk about some really interesting stuff.
I was going to say, someone
was talking about gas and energy prices, and it then folded into this conversation about how much our bills were. A friend of mine said he only pays £40 a month for his gas and electricity. And again, it was exactly, I was like, are you sure, mate? I mean, that is really suspiciously low. I know you live by yourself in a one bedroom flat, but how? To which someone said, because he lives in the dark and never turns his heat off. And then I think he checked, and I said, wait, are you on a smart meter or is this on meter readings? And have you given a meter reading? You might want to check, because you might get a big bill. And he's like, no, I give meter readings all the time. I think he did check his bill and he came back and he said that actually it wasn't £40, it was £47. But there was incredulity from a number of us who were saying, how can you be spending so little money on that? But the conversation there, the conversation with you, you know, it does illustrate how this varies.
I live in a shoebox,
really, quite Simon, wildly for people.
You know, absolutely does.
Our electricity bill here isn't much more than sort of £25 a month.
Well, electricity.
It's the gas prices that absolutely, you know, add to that.
Yeah, and you're right. That's a really important thing to remember, actually, Lee, because the same here. Our electricity bill is, I'm looking at it now, is £67 in middle of January to the middle of February. And I mean, I don't live in a particularly big house, but I do. It's a reasonable sized house. And I do have children who love to switch every light in the house on and then leave them on. And I have become that dad going around the house, turning the lights off. We do have a tumble dryer, all that kind of stuff. We don't have a dishwasher, but apparently dishwashers are more efficient than washing stuff by hand. But we don't have an immersion or something like that that's sending it up. But so we're spending £67, but that pales into insignificance compared to the £106 that we spent on gas over the same month. And I guess that's the bit where there's a bit of hope for people, and people are going to win out, is that obviously your energy bills and your direct debit tends to be smoothed over the 12 months. But the good news is that the price cap is going up in April, and that's going to be the point at which a lot of people really can either stop using their heating a lot or dial it down. And we had more people telling us to turn our thermostat down by a degree today, I believe.
Yeah. It can save you £80 apparently a year. So there you go.
This is the problem with this kind of stuff, isn't it? Someone says, well, I can save you £80 a year, and you go, okay, how much is that a month? And you think, okay, well, you know what, if it comes down to it, if someone came up to me at the beginning of the month and said, you can either be warm enough or always slightly cold and it'll cost you £6, you might say, here's my £6. Mm. But every little helps, and that's not the way to think when you're trying to save energy and money.
Exactly, right.
I think actually people, you know, have got bored of that, turn the thermostat down a degree. You know, that's been sort of rammed down our throats a lot. I think what a lot of people don't do, and I had been guilty of this until recently, is going around from room to room and turning down valves into rooms that you're not in very much or don't need heating to give more of a balance around the house. I think there should be more of a drive to turn down your valve and notch on your radiators. There we go.
And wear comfy jumpers as well, like we're doing at the moment on this. I've actually turned mine more than a notch or two down my thermostat. It's about 16 and a half at the minute. Where does pipes freeze? Anyway, we're going to leave energy to one side because doubtless we're going to talk about this again. It keeps on rolling on, sadly. But Let's talk about everybody's favourite reward system. Except me. I like boots, I'll be honest. But Avios points. I have some, apparently. I don't know what to do with them, but I have them nonetheless. A Barclay card has launched two new credit cards, giving its customers the opportunity to collect Avios points for every £1 spent. So is it time to get involved? Avios points. I ask you this every time we cover a story on Avios points, because, again, like I have like tens of thousands of these things. I've absolutely no idea why, but I've no idea what to do with them either. Simon, you look confused.
Tens of thousands?
Yeah. Like, I don't know. Like,
Can you gift them? Lee, can you gift Avios points? Can we have Georgie's?
Yeah, you can. I know that much. It says on my little BA account or Nectar points or something. I don't know. Either I'm doing a lot of shopping at Sainsbury's or...
Hang on a minute. Have you got 30,000 Avios points or 30,000 Nectar points?
Some ID fraud and I'm not actually me and my energy bills are completely wrong and my Nectar points... What did you say?
I think 30,000 Nectar points might be worth less than 30,000 Avios points.
I'm going to let you two gas on about this and I'm going to try and Google. I don't know where I'd go. Where do you find out what your Avios points are?
If you
don't throw this podcast together, you know, people.
Shopping in Sainsbury's, you can convert your Nectar points now into Avios. That was a change that happened last year at some point. And that's what a lot of people are doing and taking advantage of. But you have to go through and actually convert those into Avios if you want them.
And surely it's not one for one either, is it?
I can't really remember. I don't think it is. No, I don't think it quite is. Yeah, when you've got tens of thousands of Avios, really, in terms of flights, it's going to be difficult to really get a noticeable difference on your flight. You know, if you're a serious Avios collector, really, you need six figures. You need 100,000 points or more, to be quite frank. And even then, it's not the easiest to spend those points, which we've talked about on this podcast before. But let me tell you about the details of this Barclay card, right? And my theory behind what's going on. I think Barclay card and some other major credit card providers are struggling a little bit to attract new customers. American Express is taking a big chunk of the market in Britain because of Avios and collecting points, and they've really sort of cornered the market in terms of people like to spend on a credit card, they like to collect the points, and then the golden rule is to pay it off as you go along. So this is not a credit card that you take out, do some spending on it, leave it on there, because you'll get charged sky high APR, right? So there's a lot of people out there that do their everyday spending on credit cards for the rewards. And a lot of people have turned to American Express for that. So number one, I think Barclay Card are looking to kind of cut into a bit of that market. They've realised that people do quite like collecting points like Avios. And that's why this has happened. The other thing, and this is something I'd written a story about a fair few years back, is the buy now, pay later sort of craze that's gone on in the last couple of years. That has bitten into the credit card market massively, and especially so for the under 35s. You know, buy now, pay later is here. It looks like it's here to stay. And for that reason, I think quite a lot of younger people just shunning credit cards altogether. You know, buy now, pay later is almost like their version of the credit card. And I think Barclay card is wising up to that a bit. And these two Avios cards that they've launched are actually quite generous and probably the most generous credit card launch for a fair while. So there's a free version of the account. You'll get 5,000 Avios points if you spend £1,000 in the first month, and you get like for like points. So a point for every pound spent, right? Now there's a paid for one. And I guess this paid for one is the one that's going up against the Amex Gold card. Now the Amex Gold card is free for the first year, but then from year two onwards is £140. But you can cancel it and you can have that prorated back and you can move on to a free card from the American Express. Now they're offering this Avios Plus card, Barclay card, 25,000 points if you spend £3,000 in the first 3 months. And then you get one and a half points for every quid spent. And that comes with a £20 monthly fee. So it's more expensive than the Amex. But our friend Rob Burgess, who runs the website Head for Points, rightly points out that you could quite easily cancel in the app and move on to its free card. So let's say you triggered that that bonus 25,000 points within 2 months, you know, which is not outside the realms of everyday spending for people. You could basically collect those points, move on to a free card. And that's a very, very astute way of boosting your Avios pot and getting, you know, some serious uplift. And that's it, really. And that's what people do. They do their everyday spending on it, and then they just pay it off as they go along. You know, and with a cost of living crisis, again, I think people just like to feel like they're getting something for their spending, but you have to be careful. You cannot let it roll over. It is something that you must be guaranteed that you know you can pay off every month, and that you will do it and you won't forget, because otherwise it makes all of this pointless. So you have to be quite regimented about doing this and collecting the points. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think Avios have taken quite a big hit in terms of people collecting points, because A, they've been hard to spend because of the pandemic, but B, a lot of people that do collect them are people that are collecting them from business and through business. And again, a lot of those kind of spending patterns have been hit by the pandemic. So it's kind of a bit of exciting credit card news, Georgie. That's all I can say. You know, it's I think it's a good bet if you are someone who is into collecting Avios, who can get flights of this, knows how to play the system. And it's good competition for American Express.
Yeah. I can report during that I have 24,261 Avios points.
Mm-hmm. It's not a catchy name, is it, Avios?
It would get you to Europe and back, wouldn't it?
Marvellous.
Well, it used to be Air Miles, didn't it, back in the day?
Yeah, but now they argue that you can use it for other things and other spending. Yeah.
You can use it to buy the world's most expensive sandwich on a BA flight, can't you? You can actually buy sandwiches and drinks with Avios, which you work it back to the amount of money you initially had to spend in order to earn those Avios points. Mm. Makes the sandwich about £100 sandwich.
You need to go off with a really, really massive calculator, a big pad, and have a look at where you can fly around the world and figure out what is giving you the most bang for your point. And I tell you, that is the kind of job on a rainy afternoon that can take quite a lot of time.
I thought you were about to say you needed to get on the plane with a really big calculator and a massive pad, and when they come around asking if you'd like a drink, you sit there and work. I'd be just for a couple of minutes, just working out how much of this will cost me and whether to pay with cash or not. Be like Lee, don't be like me. I've got an Avios credit card. I earn Avios from my American Express credit card, and every so often, and I use it to buy big purchases and stuff like that, and every so often I forget to pay the bill on time. I've got the minimum direct debit obviously going out, but I don't pay the full bill. And then I end up being charged interest over the course of the month. The interest rate on the card's, 30% or something? And I negate any benefit I've ever had from earning those Avios. So don't be like Lee. Sorry, don't be like me, be like Lee.
Exactly. How many Avios points do you have, Simon? I want an Avios point off.
I don't know, and I've got a suspicion I'll never use them.
See, this is the point, right? Anyway, I actually got a load, because this ties all in very nicely, you see. As I said, I don't throw this together. I got a load when I recently went to Barbados. I am not, sadly, the reader who wrote to you about selling their home in the Caribbean. I haven't got a home in the Caribbean. But to finish off our property holy trinity of stories, we have three, something a little bit more niche, the reader question about a Caribbean property. This is what they have to say. I am selling a property in the Caribbean and the US buyers would like to pay me in cryptocurrency. I've only used Bitcoin occasionally, but wonder if it would be a good way to transfer this considerable amount of money, $1 million plus, to me in Britain. How would you suggest I go about it, and would you recommend it?
No.
Right, there we go. Okie dokie.
I mean, the problem is if someone had paid you £1 million in Bitcoin for your property this morning, you would now have £1 million minus 4.1%, because that's what the price of Bitcoin has fallen today.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have got lucky and you could have had £1 million plus the 4%. The price of Bitcoin this week climbed up to $44,000. And has then sunk back to 41,755. That's quite a big movement. And ideally, when you're going from one currency to another, you want to limit movements. I mean, it might be that you're the kind of person who believes that Bitcoin is a long-term store of value. And so therefore, you're actually happy to just take the Bitcoin and keep the Bitcoin. That's a lot of money. to just take the Bitcoin and keep the Bitcoin, and it's going to be a fairly niche element of why you want to do it. Yes, transferring currency across costs money, but it is possible to compare that kind of thing and drive down those costs substantially. Don't just do it with your bank. Never just move money with your bank. Always do it with a Forex specialist. You can lock in rates so you can guarantee how much you're going to get if you know that you've got some money that is going to be coming or you're going to have to transfer in the future. And our friend, Glenn Goodman, friend of This Is Money, crypto expert, author of The Crypto Trader, replied to this question with, my first question would be, why do they want to pay you in a cryptocurrency? He said they may have a perfectly legitimate reason to own so much cryptocurrency, just as someone might have a perfectly legitimate reason to pay you with a suitcase full of 50 pound notes. But it's sometimes but it's sometimes used as a money laundering technique or to illegally avoid tax by keeping the payment outside of the international banking system. If their reasons appear to be legitimate, you'd be well advised to instruct a specialist cryptocurrency solicitor who has dealt with these conveyancing issues before. Transferring such a large amount of money using decentralized crypto networks can sometimes be cheap and easy, but it's not without its risks. If something goes wrong, there may be no higher authority to appeal to. I wouldn't do this kind of thing, whatever crypto it's in.
Unless you're a multi-billionaire and you just think I'll have a bit of extra crypto.
Yeah, I mean, you could use something like a stable coin. Okay, so you've got some of the stable coins, for example, Tether, which is tied to the price of the US dollar. But there is the risk that, you know, the companies backing this digital currency may not have the dollars to pay out when you actually want to cash out. Fundamentally, there is a much greater risk to you in accepting crypto than there is going through the existing legitimate financial system. Now, you might be the kind of person who doesn't like the existing legitimate financial system and you like crypto more and you think it is more fundamentally honest and you fully believe in decentralized finance. And if you are that person and you have so much money that you can take the risk with the £1 million, well, good on you. But for the vast majority of people, I don't think they'd be taking the risk with $1 million, not £1 million. But yeah, whether it's £1 million or $1 million, I don't think they'd be taking that risk. I mean, if they've got a couple of $100 million, then maybe they would.
We do get some interesting reader questions coming, don't we? I mean, I've got real sort of Hank Scorpio vibes on this one, if anyone's a Simpsons fan. Like someone, I don't know, just got a million dollar sort of crypto
transaction. Just loving they wrote to you. That's, you know, that shows exactly what they think of you.
It's a really interesting question, but I think given the reasons that Simon just mentioned, you know, the volatility, having no higher authority to take problems to, and finding, I think Len said in here about finding a specialist crypto solicitor. I mean, how you go about finding one of those, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure they exist, but I reckon it's probably quite difficult to hunt one down. But if you were ever tempted, I mean, you'd need someone that can, you know, dot all of those I's, you know. And then I think to myself, then what is the point? You know, it's almost like if you're trying to strip away having to use, you know, the big banks and, you know, the existing financial system, you want something that's going to have, you know, low fees and it for it to be beneficial and some sort of authority to be able to, you know, take problems to, but none of that exists. And it's just it's too much of a risk, George, isn't it?
And actually, in many instances, you know, if you do want to convert the crypto into hard cash, you know, actual, you know, real currency, not cryptocurrency, you know, or transfer it, it's not as cheap as it's often made out. There are fees involved, and you know, there is a cost of transaction, and the cost of transaction might very well turn out to be more than just doing it through a foreign exchange specialist with all of the protection that gives.
So again, that's a no, I think, all round. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in reader comments. And if you do have any questions about cryptocurrency that you want to send us and you want to get answered, send them to editor@thisismoney.co.uk and put crypto questions in the subject field and we will get them answered for you. Whether it's just because you want to know how it works or because you're planning on selling that place in the Caribbean that you don't need anymore.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.